From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, growing up in a liberal family in an era of liberal decline, we talk with George Packer about his new memoir, The Blood of Liberals. Packer's father was a professor and administrator at Stanford University in the late 60s and found his brand of liberalism under attack from the right and the left during the student protests. Also, we meet musician Russell Malone. He's been described as one of the most versatile and complete jazz guitarists of his generation. In addition to leading his own group, he's performed with Jimmy Smith, Harry Connick, and Diana Krall. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. NASA is about to make its fourth attempt to launch the space shuttle Discovery. Dave Pignanelli reports from member station WCPN.
This is the 100th space shuttle mission for NASA. The Discovery crew is scheduled to spend 12 days in space as the shuttle's seven astronauts deliver two key components to the International Space Station. One of those includes a giant girder-like truss, which will become the first permanent latticework structure on the space station. Over the course of 4 days, two teams of astronauts will don suits and venture into the vacuum of space floating high above the Earth. Their goal is to connect the truss, laying the groundwork for future construction flights that will lead to a permanent presence in space. The second component to be delivered is hardware that will support docking operations for future shuttle visits. NASA hopes to have a crew taking up residence on board the station by next month. For NPR News, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The two major party presidential candidates will face one another in the second debate tonight. The debate in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, will be less formal than the first one, with Republican George W. Bush and Democrat Al Gore seated at a table on either side of moderator Jim Lehrer. Foreign policy is expected to be high on tonight's agenda, especially with the ongoing crises in Israel and Yugoslavia. The Federal Aviation Administration has inspected the wiring on 81 airliners and found room for improvement, but the agency says it has no immediate safety concerns. NPR's Kathleen Chalk reports.
Engineers removed wires from high-stress areas of aircraft that were more than 20 years old. They found cracks in wiring insulation in six recently retired airliners. The agency says cracked insulation doesn't necessarily pose a risk unless it allows a wire to short with another wire on the plane. Nevertheless, the industry has become more focused on this hazard in recent years. A short circuit in the center fuel tank is suspected of causing the 1996 crash of a TWA Boeing 747 that had just taken off from New York. Wiring in the cockpit is also a potential culprit in the fiery Swissair MD-11 crash off the east coast of Canada in 1998. A government industry task force examined the wiring on the 81 aircraft as part of a wiring inspection program the FAA launched 2 years ago. Kathleen Chalk, NPR News, Washington.
A federal appeals court in Washington has thrown out federal regulations that required broadcasters to give political candidates free airtime to respond to personal attacks or station endorsements. The Federal Communications Commission has already suspended the rules through the rest of the current campaign season. FCC Chairman William Kennard said the commission will study whether new rules are needed to make sure controversial issues get balanced coverage. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 110 points, or 1%, to close at 10,413. This is NPR News. A jury in Louisiana has acquitted former Governor Edwin Edwards of federal fraud charges. Edwards was on trial with two other men. Byron Henderson reports from Louisiana Public Broadcasting in Baton Rouge.
After 4 days of deliberations, the federal jury in Baton Rouge found Edwards not guilty of witness tampering, conspiracy, and wire insurance and mail fraud. The charges stemmed from the liquidation of a failed insurance company in 1996. Edwards and two others were accused of rigging a settlement favorable to the company at the expense of creditors. Louisiana's current insurance commissioner was not so lucky. Jim Brown was convicted on seven counts of lying to investigators. A third defendant, Shreveport attorney Ronald Weems, was acquitted of all charges. However, Edwards is not completely in the clear. He still faces sentencing on a previous racketeering conviction connected to the state's riverboat gambling industry. For NPR News, I'm Byron Henderson in Baton Rouge.
Yugoslavia's new government ran into opposition today from military leaders and from supporters of ousted President Slobodan Milosevic. Backers of Milosevic in the Serbian government said they were reestablishing control over the 100,000-member Serbian police force. The Associated Press quoted a senior police official as saying that the Serbian government had made no effort to reimpose control over the police force, much of which went over to the opposition side during the massive protests against Milosevic. Senior military officials, most of them appointed by Milosevic, warned against any effort to purge them from the top ranks of the military. In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index lost 72 points, or just over 2%. It closed at 3,172. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. George Packer grew up in a liberal family in an age of liberal decline. He's heard the word liberal used as a political weapon not only by the right but by the left, which particularly in the late 60s and early 70s saw liberalism as too status quo. Packer's father was a law professor and administrator at Stanford University in the late 60s, and his brand of liberalism was under attack during the student protests. George Packer's grandfather was a liberal who represented Birmingham in the U.S. Congress from 1915 to 1937. In the new memoir, Blood of the Liberals, George Packer reflects on his political upbringing and the political changes that he, his father, and grandfather underwent. Packer is a journalist and novelist. Let's start with a reading from his new memoir.
In early 1969, my father suffered a stroke that paralyzed his right side and left him a cripple who had difficulty speaking whole sentences. He was 43 and about to leave his position as an academic administrator at Stanford to return to the rational world of teaching law. Throughout 1968, he'd been battling sit-ins and firebombings at the university while the country was torn apart by riots, assassinations, and the endless war in Vietnam. After these upheavals, the year ended with the election of Richard Nixon, the politician my father had hated all his life. At the time of his stroke, I was 8 years old. I didn't know why my father got sick. I knew still less why students shouted at him on the campus radio, why the Democratic Convention in Chicago turned into a pitched battle as we watched on television, why the word assassination put such a spell on me. But I understood with a child's clarity that the world, which not long before had been a delightful place of caterpillars and basketball, was suddenly full of danger, that the adults had lost control and were helpless to protect me. Even then I sensed my father's fragility, not just in his body but in his manner of thinking and living, that his commitment to the life of reason stood no chance against the world going mad.
And that's George Packer reading from his new memoir, Blood of the Liberals. George, your father was vice provost for academic planning at Stanford. He got that position in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
He also served on the Academic Council's Executive Committee, which also put him on the front lines in the confrontations with students. Your father was under attack from the left and the right as an academic administrator. He was under attack from the students on the left. Who was attacking him on the right?
The alumni were attacking him on the right. It went back to his hiring at Stanford in 1956. He was hired by the law school in 56, and immediately Herbert Hoover, who was a trustee of the university and really sort of the waning power behind the scenes, tried to block his appointment because his appointment had coincided with a grant from the Fund for the Republic, which was a civil liberties arm of the Ford Foundation, to study the testimony of Whitaker Chambers and other ex-communists. So his appointment became mixed up with sort of the twilight of the McCarthy era, and he was red-baited, and his appointment was nearly canceled, but in the end, the university came through. So 10 years later, when he was appointed vice provost, the ghosts of the McCarthy era came back sort of in the last gasps of conservatism at that time, and a conservative alumni group said that he would be leading students to revolt against the university, which proved deeply ironic since, in fact, those same students were attacking the appointment from the other side. And far from leading them to revolt, my father became something of a hardliner in opposing sit-ins and other student actions.
And the student body president during this period was David Harris, who became famous for being a draft resister and for marrying Joan Baez.
That's right. And he and my father tangled almost as soon as my father was appointed vice provost over a very minor-seeming issue. But in those days, every minor issue was instantly polarized and became a crisis. In this case, it was the appointment of students to a committee that my father chaired. It was a committee that was intended to reform undergraduate education. My father's idea was the research university had lost its way and had begun to ignore both undergraduate education and basic questions of value and humanistic scholarship, and he wanted to reorient it towards students and toward value questions. So this committee was intended to make Stanford, in a way, a more student-friendly place. But David Harris saw simply the administration trying to strong-arm students to bend to its will. So it became a power struggle between them. It also became a struggle over the question of whether it's possible to be disinterested, to be an intellectual with an independent mind that does not simply reflect your status and your power. My father staked his life on a belief that that was possible, but David Harris and the students were suspicious of those claims. They thought any claim to being independent was just a cover for university power.
What kind of decisions did your father have to make in the confrontations with students? Like, was he involved with deciding whether to call the police onto the campus or not, which is one of the big questions that university administrators had to deal with?
Right. Well, the climactic event of his career was a student sit-in in May of 1968 that followed the Columbia takeover by just a week. And the example of Columbia was vivid in everyone's mind of the cops coming in and using batons to clear out buildings and horses stampeding up Broadway. So no one in the administration wanted to call in the police. My father's position, in a way, was a legalistic one. His position was that the students were using coercion to try to change university policy on student discipline, basically. And he thought it was illegitimate, that the only legitimate means of persuasion in an intellectual institution was rational debate. And so because of that belief, he was he became quite polarized from the students, quite hostile to the takeover, and really unwilling to negotiate with them. But as it turned out, he was not in the power position. Because the administration and the students were so hostile to each other, the faculty had to step into the breach to resolve it. And what the faculty did was essentially to give in to the student demands, which my father thought was a disaster. And he actually drafted a resignation letter, but he decided not to resign. Instead, he became a very vocal and pointed, barbed speaker against both the student and the faculty. And for a period, he was quite an isolated figure on campus.
And then your father had a stroke and he had to stop teaching altogether. It strikes me as a really thankless time to have been a university administrator. Was your father sorry that he had left teaching and become an administrator?
I think so. His pride might have kept him from admitting that he was not up to the job, that the job defeated him. But if you read between the lines of some of his letters, you see that there's a lot of regret and anger, really anger, at all sides, at the students, at the faculty, at the administration, the trustees. He was sort of embattled on all fronts in his years as an administrator. And in a way, he wasn't cut out to be an administrator. He didn't understand consensus. He saw Stanford as an institution of intellectual freedom rather than as a community that needed to have all its members getting along. He was really ready to do battle on issues of principle rather than to assuage feelings. So I don't think he was a good administrator. I think it was a mistake for him to take it. And at one point after his stroke, he wrote a letter to a friend saying, in 1966, I was stupid enough to become an administrator. I've since suffered a stroke, whether as punishment or just consequence, I don't know. So in the irony of that, you can hear his bitterness at those years.
Now, you were very young when your father was an administrator at Stanford.
Yeah,
you were
just a kid.
About eight during the period that we're talking about. And you write in your book that you felt the adults had lost control. What are some of your memories of the student protests?
In a way, I was sort of out of it. I was far more interested in the presidential campaign of 1968. So my memories of student protest were quite sketchy in the years when my father was on the front lines. After his stroke, I think that put my own family and our community onto my psychic map in a way they hadn't been before. I had to focus on the world immediately around me and get out of this abstract interest in politics. And then I was frightened. I felt that we were sort of under siege. We had security floodlights installed. We had a hotline to the police. There were phone calls that were unpleasant. There was the campus radio broadcasting speeches in which my father and others were spoken of with a lot of contempt and hostility. Basically fear. And worry about my parents, worry that they weren't up to it and were going to be overwhelmed by all this passion.
My guest is George Packer. His new memoir is called Blood of the Liberals. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. George Packer is my guest, and his new memoir is called Blood of the Liberals. Your grandfather was a congressman from Alabama serving in the U.S. Congress from 1915 to 1937.
Right, my mother's father.
Yeah, and he thought of himself as a liberal. What did liberal mean to your grandfather?
To him, it meant that he was on the side of the common people, or what he called the plain people, against concentrations of power. And it really went back to Jefferson and to the idea that for America to be a republic of free and equal people, no group could gain too much power over any other group, political or economic. We needed everyone, in Jefferson's view, to have 50 acres and a public education in order to remain a democracy. And my grandfather tried to carry that idea into the 20th century. He was born in the middle of the 19th century, just after the Civil War, and his career, he lived a very long time until 1960. His career essentially covered the years of reform in the populist, progressive, and New Deal era, but he was unable to translate Jeffersonian ideas into the 20th century because when finally the New Deal seemed to enact the political principles that my grandfather had been living by, that is to say, fighting on behalf of poorer people, using government to create justice and equality. He took a look at the New Deal and he hated it. It didn't look anything like Jeffersonian democracy. In fact, it looked to him more like corporate control, except now the control was in the hands of government bureaucrats instead of Wall Street bankers. In a sense, he was an old-fashioned populist, which made him a liberal until the New Deal, and then it made him a conservative. He claimed he didn't change at all. It was the definitions of the words that changed. But in his last debate in Congress, an opponent said to him, "It's pathetic that the liberal hero of my youth is going to go down to defeat as the conservative gentleman from Birmingham, Alabama." And in fact, he was defeated, and that was the end of his career.
What are some of the beliefs that you were brought up on that you identified with liberalism?
Basically, it came down to sympathy with the black and the poor. The idea that middle-class people had an obligation to help the disadvantaged. And race was really prominent in my childish consciousness, largely because of my mother, who grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, and brought to California a strong Southern consciousness of race guilt and race obligation. So I had this burden placed on me pretty young that nothing was free. I wasn't to go through life simply racking up my own achievements, that I had an obligation to be concerned about the poor and the black. Now, how this translated into policy is another matter, and in some ways it did so rather ineffectively. The emotions were quite strong, but the policies, I think, were vulnerable, and I only began to question them once I left home and grew up and saw something of the world.
Which policies did you question? What did you question about them?
I began to question everything. I mean, I still call myself a liberal, but on the other hand, the liberal positions on things like welfare and taxes and crime and patriotism and affirmative action were really open to attack because they were positions held by people who didn't seem to have to give up anything. They were entitled positions that were asking sacrifices of other people who had more to give up. An issue like busing, for example. There's a moment in my book which is kind of painful for me to recall because I don't think it was fun for my mother to recall it. But when I was about 13 or 14, the Boston busing crisis was in full swing. And I knew that the family, were in favor of busing. But I was troubled, and I asked her, well, would you allow me to be bused? And she admitted, I think quite honestly, that she wouldn't. But she also said that education meant more to our family. And that struck me at the time as a hard thing to swallow, and I think it might have struck her in the same way once she said it. It was an honest moment, and probably she was speaking for a lot of liberals at the time who were for busing in the abstract, but maybe not in their own neighborhood. And that made liberals extremely vulnerable to the charge of hypocrisy and of being out of touch with the world and of making decisions for people that they themselves didn't have to live by. And I think that picture of the liberal consigned a whole series of Democratic candidates to defeat.
Now, you went to the Peace Corps, I guess, when you got out of college, and
yes,
taught English in Togo. Now, we had discussed this on Fresh Air years ago, but tell us again. You went there with all these, like, liberal ideals and beliefs, and you came home early. Why?
Yeah. Well, it's not quite as simple as I was disillusioned by the world and found I couldn't put my liberal beliefs into practice, because actually I didn't go quite as naive as that. I basically wanted an adventure. I wanted to find out who I was, and the old path of the military didn't appeal to me, but the Peace Corps seemed to offer the same test. And I guess I failed it in the sense that I went home early. It was really more of an existential crisis and something of a psychological crisis. I lost faith in myself and in the way I'd been raised and in who I was. Something about being alone in a little village in West Africa for weeks on end undermined me, and I came home early, really, in order to save my life. I'm not sure I would have survived. My father's suicide was haunting me when I was in Africa. I thought about it all the time, and I think it was a good thing that I got out of there, although I left with an acute sense of failure and really carried that with me for years, and that influenced the direction I took when I got back to the United States.
Your father committed suicide 3 years after his stroke. Why was it in Africa that you started thinking about it so much?
Because I was left alone for such long periods of time that it was inevitable to be in a little cement room in the middle of the day when absolutely nothing is stirring except a rooster. In the heat, without a telephone, without electricity, without a television, there were no distractions. And without distractions, I suddenly found myself face to face with the past and with my father. And I had this strange sense that I was going to live out his fate. And in fact, one night, I became convinced that I was about to have a stroke and die, just as, you know, as he had a stroke in this remote part of Africa. And I had a local driver rush me to the hospital where a German doctor assured me that I was fine.
What was the problem?
Beginning nervous breakdown was his diagnosis.
Is that part of what sent you home?
Yeah, it wasn't at that moment, but that was the kind of thing that sent me home. Too many beginning nervous breakdowns, and you actually have a nervous breakdown.
Your book is called Blood of the Liberals, and it's mostly a memoir, not only about your life, but about your grandfather's life and your father's life and their political and intellectual beliefs. Do you feel like you have inherited something of their liberal beliefs? And why did you call it Blood of the Liberals?
I have inherited something, which I have to then make my own. It's called Blood of the Liberals because, first of all, the word liberals is used deliberately. As I said, I don't want to run away from that word. I think it's a worthy word and needs rehabilitation. Blood because, first of all, it is about bloodlines. It's about inheritance and legacy and how each generation has to grapple with the beliefs and the experiences of the last generation, but then has to grapple also with its own times. And there's a line in the book where I say the story of my family is the story of an inherited idea crashing up against the hard rock of new circumstance. So with each generation, the inherited idea, which broadly is liberalism, had to contend with new forces and new historical circumstances and had to be remade, had to change its shape. And I think in both the case of my grandfather and my father, they weren't able to make it change in a way that they could use. In other words, they clung to an idea that outlived its viability, and they both paid a price for it.
Well, George Packer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
George Packer's new memoir is called Blood of the Liberals. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of Pagan Babies, a new novel by Elmore Leonard. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We're listening to music from the latest CD by jazz guitarist Russell Malone. Coming up, we talk to Malone about his music and his work with Jimmy Smith and Diana Krall. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before he started leading his own group, Russell Malone was best known as the guitarist with the group led by singer and pianist Diana Krall. He had also performed with Jimmy Smith and Harry Connick. But now Malone is recognized as one of the leading jazz guitarists of his generation. In the New York Times, he was described as both a historian of the guitar and the heir of the great jazz guitarists from Charlie Christian through George Benson. Malone will perform at the San Francisco Jazz Festival, which begins later this month. Here's the title track from his latest CD, Look Who's Here. The track we've been listening to is an original composition. Russell Malone also loves standards and movie themes. His new CD includes songs by Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, Burt Bacharach, and Lerner and Lowe, as well as the theme from the film, An Affair to Remember. I asked him about his love of songs.
Well, I mean, a lot of those songs are, you know, like Stardust, Heather on the Hill, which I recorded. Those songs are so well constructed. Those guys, Cole Porter, George Gershwin, Jerome Kern, those guys were, I don't know what their women told them, but they wrote some beautiful lyrics and the songs are so well constructed, you really don't have to do much else to them. I also like to write my own tunes. I like to play songs by Wayne Shorter. I just like music, but I love the classic American songs and I always play them whenever I play concerts, along with some of my own tunes too.
You actually sing an Irving Berlin song on your latest CD. You sing Be Careful, It's My Heart. Why did you decide to sing? It's your first time singing on record that I know of.
Well, actually, I used to sing in church, and it's not my first time singing on record. About 10 years ago, when my first record came out on Columbia, I sang a song called I Don't Know Enough About You. So I like to sing, but I'm a guitar player first. That's what I do. But I appreciate a good song, and I listen to a lot of singers.
Well, let's hear it. This is Be Careful, It's My Heart, Russell Malone, voice and guitar from his recent CD, Look Who's Here.
Be careful. It's my heart. It's not my watch you're holding. It's my heart. It's not the note I sent you that you quickly burn. It's not the book I lent you that you never return. Be careful. It's my heart. The heart with which so
Russell Malone from his recent CD, Look Who's Here. You strike me as somebody with a big voice when you're speaking who's singing in a much quieter voice. So what reaction have you been getting?
You know what? A lot of people really like that song. They like my rendition of it. And I'm not a singer. I can carry a tune. I just sing the melody. And, you know, when you got a good song like that, you don't have to try to sell it. All you have to do is just sing it because, I mean, the lyrics are there, the melody is there, and, I mean, the harmony is of the song is great. So all you have to do is just sing it.
You know, I think you first became known as the guitarist with singer Diane Krall a few years ago. How did you get to play with her?
Well, before that, I'd also spent time with Jimmy Smith. I spent 4 years with Harry Connick after that. I played with Eddie Cleanhead Vince and played with a lot of people before getting in Diana's band. Now, the way that we met was in New York City at a place called Bradley's, which is no longer open. She came to hear me play. I was playing that week with Mo Gru Miller, wonderful pianist, and Peter Washington, great bassist. And I'd already heard of her, but I hadn't really checked her out. So she told me that she was getting ready to go into the studio and do a tribute to Nat King Cole, which turned out to be the record All For You. And some people had suggested that she, if she hadn't found a guitar player yet, to go down to Bradley's and check me out. So she came down, and we talked about it, and she was very, very pleasant, very personable. And she'd also heard that I'd played with Freddie Cole, who's Nat King Cole's younger brother, so I had an understanding of that music. So we went into the studio. Well, first we went on the road and played for a few months, and then we went into the studio and made this record. And that's how we hooked up.
Why don't we hear a track that you recorded with Diane Krall from her tribute record to Nat Cole called All For You. And this is Erin Boy for Rhythm, which she changed to Erin Girl for Rhythm. And my guest Russell Malone featured on guitar.
Here's something that I'd like to bring to you. Wrapped all in cellophane, designed for you. Tell you what it's all about. It is without a doubt a swing in the latest style. A service with a smile if you want to swing and shout. Get your heels and gad about. I'm an errand girl for rhythm. Send me. Just get hip and follow through. I'll deliver straight to you. I'm an errand girl for rhythm. Send me. You can always find me down at Smokey Joe's. That's where all the hip and groovy people go. If you want variety, take a tip and call for me. I'm an errand girl for rhythm. Send me.
Guitarist Russell Malone with singer and pianist Diane Krall. Russell Malone, you left Diane Krall's group in 1999. Why did you want to leave? Why was it time for you to go?
Well, I mean, all good things must come to an end. And, you know, it was time to move on because people... I'd done three records there, and I'd spent 4 years there, and I wanted to try to... I wanted to play with some other musicians. And... along with playing with my own band, because people, if you stay in a situation too long, people start to typecast you, and I think that that's one of the worst things that can happen to anybody, be it an actor or a musician or whatever. I didn't want to end up in that situation. People started to associate me with playing that particular style of music, and it's great music, but anybody who knows me, that they know that that's one dimension. I've... played with several other musicians like Kenny Barron, where the music is a bit edgier, has more of an edge to it. Doesn't make it any better. It doesn't mean that it's any better, but it's just, you know, I have other sides to me that I would like to share with people.
My guest is guitarist Russell Malone. His latest CD is called Look Who's Here. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is jazz guitarist Russell Malone. His latest CD is called Look Who's Here. A song you've recorded twice is Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, both solo guitar versions. Is that one of the songs you used to do in church?
Yeah. In fact, I used to play it at funerals. I played it at my grandfather's funeral.
Oh.
Swing Low, Sweet Chariot.
So it's a song that really means a lot to you.
It's a song that, well, all of those songs mean a lot to me. But that one in particular, it really, my heart aches when I hear it.
Well, why don't we hear it? And this is from your previous CD, which is called Sweet Georgia Peach. This is Russell Malone. Russell Malone from his CD, Sweet Georgia Peach, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. It's a beautiful version of that. Now, you primarily taught yourself to play guitar, so clearly you must have a very good ear, but what about things like fingerings?
I mean, what about it?
Did you learn that yourself? Did you just, like, make that up yourself, or did you have people to suggest fingerings before?
I just figured it out, but, you know, when you get older and you become more exposed to other players, You find out what they're doing, and you try to pick up what you can from them. You know, every time Jim Hall or George Benson or somebody like that is playing, I always make a point of going to check them out, and if I'm lucky, sit down and watch them up close, and try to walk away with something, because there's only so much you can learn on your own.
Were there any things that you figured out on your own, and then you met a more experienced guitarist and realized that there was a better way of going about it, better way of, like, fingering the chord or whatever, and you had to unlearn what you'd taught yourself and learn something new, which can be very difficult.
Well, I'll give an example. I remember one time I was playing for Kenny Burrell. This was about 2 years ago when he played the Blue Note. I picked up his guitar in the dressing room, and I started playing some solo guitar. And most guys, when they play solo guitar, they use the thumb, and when they play fingerstyle, they use the thumb and the three or four fingers on the right hand. Now, I was playing with the thumb and the index finger. Now, that may seem crude or wrong to somebody, but the music came out right, and Kenny Burrell said, "Hey, man, that's a very unique way of approaching that style." George Benson, he saw me doing the same thing. He said, "That's really weird, but it sounds so good." So it's there's no right or wrong way to do anything, as long as the music comes out right. That's the bottom line. Dizzy Gillespie played wrong technically. I mean, you didn't see any trumpet players playing with all that air in their cheeks. Wes Montgomery used the thumb when most guys were using a pick, but Wes Montgomery got around that guitar just as well as the guys that were using a pick. So does that make it wrong? No. The important thing is the music.
You have a great story about the first time you sat in with the organist Jimmy Smith when you were still pretty young. Would you tell that story for us?
Well, he was playing at a place called Pasco's La Carousel in Atlanta. This is back in 1986. And I had been listening to Jimmy since I was knee-high to a grasshopper, so I knew his music. And I got off my gig at the Holiday Inn and drove down to the club to see him play. Before he got on the bandstand, I mean, the way he walked around the club, the way he approached the bandstand, I mean, he just had this aura about him. I mean, they're just certain guys. When they're away from their instruments, they're still swinging. They have this charisma. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Milt Jackson was like that. Even when he was away from that bandstand, he was just still grooving, man. And that's the way Jimmy Smith was. But anyway, when he got on the stand, when he got on the bandstand, he played beautifully. And then he closed out the set, went over to the bar, and he was talking with this saxophone player, one of the local guys, a fellow by the name of Sil Austin. And so Sil introduced me to Jimmy and said, hey, you know, this is Russell Malone, a fine up-and-coming young guitarist. He said, oh, yeah? He said, you got your guitar? I said, yes, it's in the car. So he made me go get my guitar. And I came back, and he played one or two tunes, and then he called me up to sit in with the band. And I had some of my buddies there with me, and I had my girlfriend at the time with me. So I'm feeling really good. And everybody was excited because here's the hometown kid getting a chance to sit in with the great Jimmy Smith. So he kicked off the first tune, which was a blues. And I'm feeling all good about myself. And I'm playing all of this crowd-pleasing nonsense that didn't have any substance to it. And the crowd went wild. And, you know, I'm catting up there, feeling good. So Jimmy's sitting back. And he's paying attention to all of this. So he ended the tune. Then he went into a ballad, which I didn't know, a tune called Laura by David Raskin. You know that tune?
I do, and it's a haunting melody, but it's also it doesn't have a predictable melody line or chords.
See, that's the thing. See, that's not one of those tunes that you can just hear your way through. You have to really know that song.
It's the theme from the movie, by the way.
Yeah.
For listeners who don't know it, yeah.
So you have to really know that song. So he plays the melody, and I'm there trying to hear what he's doing. And then after he finishes the melody, he motions for me to take the first solo. And the harder I struggled with the tune, the more complicated he made it for me, because he started throwing in all of these different substitutions and changes and started doing tricks with the rhythm. And I was really embarrassed. I was mortified. So he ended the song, and he says, yeah, it's Russell Malone on guitar. So I got off the bandstand, my spirit dragging, sat back down next to my girlfriend, and he looked over at me and said on the mic, he says, now, whenever youngsters sit in with us, we always like to make sure that they learn something. And he looked at me and said, now, did you learn something, young man? And I said, yes. So anyway, he played one more tune, ended the set, went back over to the bar, and he's, you know, having a drink with some friends. So I was so embarrassed, I was going to leave, but I figured I better stay around and thank him for the opportunity. So I walked up to him, and I was about to say, Mr. Smith, thank you for letting me sit in. But before I could get the sentence out of my mouth, he looked around and he said something to me, and I will never forget this as long as I live. He looked at me and poked his finger in my chest and said, let me tell you something. He said, all those guys that you're trying to play like, George Benson, Kenny Burrell, Wes Montgomery, Pat Martino, he gave me this long list of guitar players. He said, all of these guys that you're trying to play like, I knew them and I taught them too. And I never forgot that. So anyway, I stayed around. I didn't leave. I stayed around until the last set was over. And then we went up to his dressing room at around midnight. We hung out there till like 6:30 the next morning. I had my guitar with me, and I was playing for him. And he, you know, when you get, I don't know if you've ever met Jimmy Smith, but Jimmy is an interesting guy. He's a bit of a character. And when there are a lot of people around, he tends to put on this act. You ever seen people like that?
Mm-hmm.
When they have an audience, they put on this act. But when it was just the two of us one-on-one, I got so much information from this man. And, you know, it's funny. Whenever he would talk about Wes Montgomery and Bud Powell and Art Tatum and all of these people, he would get very emotional. You could see the tears welling up in his eyes.
One of the things I really like about this story is that after he kind of makes a point of putting you in your place on the bandstand, then you become buddies, you know, like within an hour of that, or an hour or two, you know, and you stay up all night together. He's teaching all these things. It's like he showed you up, but he really apparently did mean well. And
that's a perfect example of tough love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tough love. It's just like, you know, here I was this cocky kid, and I made the mistake of, and this was a very foolish mistake, of thinking that just because I'd listened to his records and I'd, you know, learned some of the solos or whatever, learned some of his songs, I thought that that's the way it was going to be. But I was in for a rude awakening. And, you know, records are only a small part of the story. They're just snapshots in sound. And I made this stupid assumption, and then I got up there with this cocky attitude. So I had it coming.
Do you have younger musicians who want to sit in with you now, and how do you handle it?
Well, I let people sit in. I think that that's a good thing to do. Years ago, it used to be where musicians would always get a chance to sit in with the masters if they, I'm not that I'm calling myself a master or anything, but guys who are more established. And if you have the talent, then come on up there, let's have a good time, and who knows, maybe you'll get a gig in my band or somebody else will hear you and you'll get a gig. But the bottom line is that you would play with these people and it provided an opportunity for you to be heard. I know I never turn anybody away. If they have some degree of talent, I let them sit in.
My guest is guitarist Russell Malone. His latest CD is called Look Who's Here. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is jazz guitarist Russell Malone. You've been influenced by a lot of guitarists, some of whose names you've mentioned during the course of our interview. I'm sure you've like studied their records and learned to play in their style. What's it like to develop your own voice after being influenced by the voices of others?
Well, first of all, Terry, I think that everybody has their own voice. What everybody doesn't have early on is the confidence to speak with that voice. Obviously, I've been influenced by all of these guys that we mentioned before. And for a while, I felt that I had to play that way, or play like these guys, or play certain kinds of styles or certain kinds of tunes. I felt that I had to play certain kinds of tunes because, you know, when you're young, you tend to, you're seeking approval and you want people to like you. And you don't always have the confidence to say, hey, this is me. But as you get older, then your confidence comes. And I've come to realize that no matter how much I love Wes Montgomery, Kenny Burrell, Joe Pass, and all of these guys, no matter how much I love them and no matter how great they are, I'm still the best Russell Malone there is. Nobody's going to cut Russell Malone at being Russell Malone.
Right.
Yeah.
What are some of the musicians or some of the recordings you've listened to over the years that are quite a distance away from what you actually play, but you love what they do, and it's influenced you in some way or another? You know, things that we'd
you mean
be
aside from jazz?
Yeah, or even within jazz, things that we might be surprised that you really like and feel very strongly about.
Well, I like a lot of different things, Terry. There's one record that I've been listening to called "New Moonshine" by James Taylor. It came out about 9 years ago, which is it's a great record.
This is singer-songwriter James Taylor.
James Taylor, yeah.
No, what
Fire and Rain, James Taylor.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you hear in him?
Well, James Taylor, he's got honesty, man. I mean, he's got the passion, and he writes great songs. The man writes good songs. Jim Croce, I like. I love Jim Croce. I like Patsy Cline. I like Sam Cooke. As far as jazz goes, let's see. One of my favorite records is a record that was recorded by Oscar Peterson and Milt Jackson and Ray Brown years ago called Very Tall. Great record. I listen to a lot of different things, Terry. I'd be here all day telling you about what I listen to.
You have a song that you do on your previous CD, the Sweet Georgia Peach CD, called Someone's Rockin' My Dreamboat.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard of that song before. Where did you find it?
You're not going to believe it when I tell you this. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Are you sure you're ready for this, Terry?
I'm sitting down.
Okay. Bugs Bunny. I kid you not.
Would he sing it in a cartoon? Because Bugs is the great vaudevillian of the Warner Brothers cartoons.
But there, you watch some of those old cartoons, and there are a lot of great songs in there. But this one day, I was watching Bugs Bunny, and he was skipping through the forest singing this song. Someone's rocking my dreamboat. Someone's invading my dream. We were sailing along and singing this song, and suddenly something went wrong. And I was just so taken by the melody, and so I said, I got to find this tune. So I found a recording of the Ink Spots doing it. Remember the Ink Spots?
Sure do.
If I didn't care. And would I be sure that this is love beyond compare? Would all this be true if I didn't care for you? Anyway, so much for that. No, but the Ink Spots, I have a recording of the Ink Spots doing that tune, and I had to record it. I should play that again. I haven't played it in a while.
Oh, it's a great song. It's great. One extreme to another, Bugs Bunny to the Ink Spots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bugs Bunny. That's where I first heard that tune. But he used to do a lot of, Bugs Bunny would sing a lot of great songs in that movie. By the waterfall, I'm calling you. Remember that one?
It's from one of the Busby Berkeley movies.
And then there was April Showers. He sang there were a lot of good songs in those cartoons.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I think it's only fitting that we end with Someone's Rockin' My Dreamboat. Russell Malone, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
That's Someone's Rockin' My Dreamboat from Russell Malone's CD, Sweet Georgia Peach. His latest CD is called Look Who's Here. He'll perform at the San Francisco Jazz Festival, which begins October 25th. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. From Saab, introducing its new 2001 lineup, featuring the OnStar voice-activated telematics system. Information available at saabusa.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of 1863. The Rebirth of a Nation, A History of a Year in America's Past by Joseph E. Stevens, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, what it's like to live with and recover from a traumatic brain injury. We talk with Tim Wright, who suffered such an injury when he was attacked in Bolivia, where he was doing AIDS-related research. And we meet his brother, criminologist Richard Wright, who worked with Tim during the recovery. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.